From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. This week on Soundings, discussions about two aspects of the American landscape: the anthropology of hunting in the American South, and the role of agriculture in the writing of American history. First on this edition of Soundings, a conversation with an anthropologist who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. Stuart Marks is the author of a forthcoming study entitled Southern Hunting in Black and White. During his fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Stuart Marks investigated ways in which the practice of hunting in the American South conveys meaning and values at personal and social levels. According to Stuart Marks, hunters in the American South represent a conspicuous social group that provides an understanding of important contemporary symbols, rituals, and myth. Stuart Marks, let's begin with a question about the title of your project at the Humanities Center, Southern Hunting in Black and White. What's that all about?
Well, what I'm writing on is both a social history of hunting in the South, how Southerners express themselves through hunting, and also an interpretation of how they go about doing it, who they hunt with, how they do it. That's all ritual activities and their patterns to that, and interpreting that as a part of their own Southerness is what the manuscript is about.
Stuart Marks, what's the time frame? You're writing about hunting in the South right now, or what?
Well, I'm writing about it in all periods, from the beginning of colonization, that people, settlers, came to the New World. And one of the things that they did was hunt primarily for food. Mm-hmm. And then as other classes settled in and you had plantations, for example, hunting became much more structured and much more patterned, and people began to hunt for different reasons than just for food. Mm-hmm. In fact, the large plantation owners hunted primarily for the process itself, the way in which they differentiated themselves from the hunting done by other people, both poor whites and blacks, was that they hunted for recreation, not for food. That it was all right for the others to hunt for food, but that was not something that they went in for.
All right, now I take it, Stuart Marks, that the black and white in your title, Southern Hunting in Black and White, denotes an ethnic or a racial dimension. Do I have that right?
That it is. It plays off of that metaphor in a way as a kind of a negative, in which there are racial components to it, being the South. And if you look today at who hunts what, when, and where, and where it's hunted, for example, you do find that blacks tend to hunt, by and large, for food still, and tend to not pursue those animals and birds which other classes, mainly people who own a lot of land, tend to go out for, such as fox hunting, such as quail, and also for deer. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that some blacks don't hunt those forms, but they're few and far between. Hunting takes its basic meaning out of the rural agrarian past, in which most of the people grew up on the farms. They participated in hunting along with their fathers. That's one of the things that they did with their fathers, and it takes on a kind of a precious quality because of that, a very effective quality because of that.
Does that mean, just parenthetically, that you're looking mainly at men rather than women?
Yes, that's another way in which this is a masculine activity, by and large, and men are the ones who do the hunting. That's not to say that some women, and mainly the upper and lower classes, don't hunt or participate in hunting with their women folks, but by and large, in the middle classes, it is men who hunt, and it provides a format for other things that may go on in the field. People make decisions, they tell stories, they tell jokes, they may gossip about other people, and those are something that really occurs in a very small intimate circle. So it's mainly friends, and being in the South, most of the lines for friendship are drawn along racial as well as socioeconomic bounds.
It sounds to me like this the activity of hunting in the South then as well as now, it's a form of perpetuating one's, what do you call it, Southernness? Do I have that right?
Southernness or one's identity as a Southerner, yes.
Is that important?
I think for most people it is important, just like identity for us all in terms of what we do and who we are is expressed in terms of identity.
Yeah, it might be the bowling league up in Pennsylvania or upstate New York or something like that, huh?
Yes, and in fact, hunting as a recreational form has been much more important in agricultural communities in the past than it is today. As the countryside has gone for agribusiness, as the small community has industrialized, people recreate in other things rather mm-hmm. than just hunting and fishing. But most of these same kind of small bonds of friends, for example, take place on the golf course, on the mm-hmm. tennis courts, and elsewhere, not in the fields. And the important point is that hunting is a social activity. It's learned behavior,
uh-huh.
and values are passed on from father to son, mainly within families. And it's a very, very intimate kind of association that is lived out in many, many rural southern areas.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say that there are bonding that takes place among rural males that, in a sense, may be used at other times when they feel threatened.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ways in which this can may take place is through poaching. I mean, certain people
yeah.
who are excluded from the system
mm-hmm.
of good jobs and good places, for example, may find ways of getting back at those in power. They know what their values are: land ownership, economic and positions in society. And one of the ways of getting back at that is to poach or burn land or whatever. In other words, to diminish the possibility that those other people have of exercising their own value systems.
Uh-huh. Stuart Marks, your topic is Southern Hunting in Black and White. I'm thinking of a notable short story by William Faulkner called The Bear. What kind of evidence do you use? Do you look at literature, things like that? Or are you, is this sort of number crunching, just statistics from one particular area? How do you work?
Heavens no. Certainly Southern hunting has been a theme that one finds in Southern literature, Faulkner,
uh-huh.
Robert Rourke, Babcock, Rubin, and the like. It hasn't been looked at from a standpoint of social science,
mm-hmm.
okay? And that's what I'm really looking at. There are a number of themes that are touched on in Southern literature, like coming of age, for example, which is what the bear is about, and
right.
also something about Southern innocence,
mm-hmm.
having to deal with their loss of innocence with reference to what they did to the land. And these things come across in many different ways, just looking at the rituals themselves and talking to people.
Now, let's come to some bottom lines here, Stuart Marks. Again, your topic is Southern hunting in black and white. Where is this study headed? Do you intend to defend the practice of hunting? Are you analyzing it? Is there a combination of those two, or am I yet another option that you might want to mention?
Well, I think there are several things that I'm writing for. I'm trying to understand myself as a hunter,
mm-hmm.
and also saying something to defending hunting in a way that it is a tradition that is passed on within families oftentimes, and whereas a lot of people who have not grown up in that tradition, they've grown up not on the farms, as
uh-huh.
most hunters have, but have grown up in the cities, and there's a different kind of viewpoint, a different idea of conceptualization of nature, for example, that's grown up in the cities.
Uh-huh.
And those people oftentimes tend to be much against violence towards nature of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm saying is that there are a lot of meaningful values and activities that involve rural people in their hunting activities,
mm-hmm.
and that are very much a part of their identity,
right.
just like things that people do in the cities are part of their identity.
Uh-huh. Is hunting really, is it necessary anymore? Is it, do we need it in the modern, not just the South, just anywhere?
Well, this is one of the rationalizations that people always give.
Mm-hmm.
For example, one of the things that hunters say is that we have transformed the landscape so much that we've gotten rid of most of the predators, and that game or many forms of wild animals which we hunt today are really serve as a crop that if they are not harvested by hunters, mm-hmm. That many of them would die mm-hmm. of starvation. And that's probably even most hunters would say is even crueler than being able to for them to be able to not only perform in their recreation, but also be able to kill the birds, and therefore act as a predator in that sense. Mm-hmm. Now, there are a lot of rationalizations. I'm not saying that some are better than others. I'm just saying that every group of people have rationalizations for what they do. And I think as an anthropologist, the patterns in people's lives and what they do is the important thing for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, hunting may change. Certainly, they're getting fewer and fewer people who grow up on the land now, so that maybe the new ethic would be animal rights and more concerned with animal rights.
Uh-huh. Stuart Marks, your topic is Southern hunting in black and white. Let's put a really dark sort of twist to this, and I'm not talking about ethnic issues. I remember reading a story called The Most Dangerous Game about a General Zaroff, I think his name is. He wants to hunt people. Does that sound comical to you? Does that sound far-fetched? Is that an element in human nature that somehow or other enters into your discussion of hunting?
Sure. I mean, the same skills that you bring to bear for killing other animals can also be used under different circumstances towards human people, towards other human beings.
Right.
And I think that's true. Most hunters don't stress that when they talk about it, but sure. Plus some of these rituals, for example, that take place with out on the open countryside with large vehicles and guns and stuff like that.
Going on safari, huh?
Can be very intimidating, right, to other people who mm-hmm. are not so wealthy. It is a display of wealth. It's a display of violence in a way. It is also a display of the means to violence, and they can be used elsewhere.
Does this bother you, Stuart? Is this an element in the whole mix here? Your investigation of hunting, does this upset you? Do you simply look at it as part of the evidence? What?
Sure, I look at it as part of the evidence. We have all sides to our own personalities, and mm-hmm. somehow we get along somehow. And none of us are all that consistent in what we, the values that we have.
Uh-huh.
And so, sure, this is a side of me that, a side that I really enjoyed with my father, growing up with him and under him and being taught certain skills. Mm-hmm. You can learn these same skills, as animal rights people would say, really in baseball, in basketball, and other things.
Mm-hmm.
And many dads in the cities participate in those sports with their kids. This happens to be a certain kind of recreation that grows up in the countryside and takes its relevance from that history.
Stuart Marks is an independent scholar who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a forthcoming study about the anthropology of hunting in the American South. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on two aspects of the American landscape continues now with a discussion featuring three other scholars who have completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. Representing Davidson College, Northwestern University, and the University of Florida, David Shy, Timothy Breen, and John Seeley each served as a faculty member recently for a summer institute for high school teachers of history convened at the National Humanities Center. The topic was agriculture and the agrarian tradition in American history. Let me begin with David Shy. Why would you run a summer institute for high school teachers around the theme of American history and use agriculture as a jumping off point? That America is no longer an agricultural society, is it?
Well, certainly not in a dominant sense, but one of the concerns that I have, and I think that Tim and John Seeley share that concern, is that too often in recent years, American historians have focused on the evolution of urban industrial life and society and the economy, and have tended to neglect or forget about the fact that American agriculture and agrarian life still represents a significant portion of American life today. And of course, historically, it has represented perhaps the dominant form of American life, until recent years. So our concern was to revive an interest in and an awareness of the subject of American agriculture and agrarian life, as well as to introduce high school teachers to some of the recent scholarship in those areas.
One of the words that that runs through this summer institute that you have been running at the Humanities Center is myth. John Seeley, how does a large term like that connect to a study of American history, particularly in agricultural terms?
Well, again, before our discussion began, you mentioned, is there a distinction between agriculture and agrarianism? Mm-hmm. What is the distinction? It seems to me that agriculture isn't a myth. I mean, there it is out there, the farmer on a plow, on his tractor pulling a plow, and the rest. It goes on as a fact. Agrarianism, which was an economic, cultural notion about the way in which people can live in relation to the land, which we identify with Thomas Jefferson, with the physiocrats of the 18th century, did create, or was the or was part of the process of a myth in creation. And so we could say that agrarianism is a myth, in the sense that it was an idea that captured the imagination of not only people like Jefferson who were worked on high, but people in general as well.
Tim Breen, let me ask you to comment on the relationship between money and agriculture in this very long-term view that you are taking of American culture and the land. Have our attitudes toward money changed in terms of agriculture? Does agriculture affect the American economic system or systems? Is that part of this myth that John Seeley mentioned?
Well, the relation of money to American agriculture is a complicated one, full of symbols, myths no doubt, and reality. There's always been a feeling from the earliest times of settlement that somehow people that are close to the land, that work the land, are purer and perhaps more virtuous. They're self-sufficient. They take care of themselves. They're independent. And the idea that they're in it for money comes to some people as a bit of a disappointment, as if it slightly sullies the image of the farmer working mm-hmm. working out there. He's not involved in wages. He doesn't work for a company. Nevertheless, farmers, the people that actually toil and do these very difficult jobs, have been interested in bettering their life and their material standing, and have worked very hard for money. And some of the most successful, most powerful political movements that this country has ever seen, I'm thinking of populism in the 1890s, had been around. One of the central issues was giving the farmer a fair share in an expanding national economy. So that the farmers are being concerned with money, but the people that wax nostalgic about farming, and oftentimes are the ones that promote the myths about the romantic farm, are the ones that wish that farmers didn't want money. It's a peculiar clash of cultures.
All right, John Seeley, Tim Breen, David Chai, you've been talking about the teaching of American history, particularly in terms of agriculture. You've referred to nostalgia, a romantic way of looking at this topic that's on the table. David Chai, let me ask you to talk about, put it to you this way, are there large misunderstandings about the role, the importance of agriculture in American history that you, that in your view need to be offset or qualified in the teaching that you're doing now for these high school teachers?
Well, there are many that come to mind, just a few that we might focus on in the next few minutes. One would be, I think, Jefferson's image in terms of the development of political economy in the United States as well as public policy. I think most school children today assume that Jefferson was an agrarian, a farmer, who promoted farming almost to the exclusion of commerce and industry and manufacturing. In fact, of course, Jefferson changed over time and recognized the reality of a growing commercial and manufacturing sectors in the economy, and came around by his presidency, as opposed to the period right after the Revolution, to advocating a balanced plan for the economy, whereby agriculture, commerce, and manufacturing would be closely monitored by public officials to make sure that these sectors of the economy remained in rough balance so that no single sector came to override the others. And yet at the same time, agriculture would be ensured to have a primary place in American life and American values. At the same time, however, there seems to be another point of view in American culture that emerges particularly during periods of economic distress for the farmers. For example, in the late 19th century, we see for the first time, really, novels appearing that present a much grimmer view of farm life and agrarian life. I'm thinking particularly of something like Hamlin Garland's Main Travel Roads. Garland grew up in the country, and he was certainly not enamored with the yeoman myth. It wasn't a rosy way of living for him, certainly, living in the 1870s and 1880s during the grim years of the economy. And the same thing happens again in an indirect way with someone like Dreiser and Sister Carrie. Sister Carrie, of course, is about a young woman who moves from the farm to the city, to Chicago, and undergoes all sorts of problems. But the fact that she is moving from farm to city was a phenomenon, of course, occurring by the millions in the late 19th century and early 20th century as we experience this dramatic demographic shift of young people moving from the farms to the cities in the hope of finding the good life and avoiding the grim drudgery, as they viewed it, of farm life. So culture frequently does mirror the difficulties of farm life at the same time that there's an underlying continuity on the other side that tends to romanticize and sentimentalize agrarian life, and that it tends to be much more popular among the reading public. Those tend to be the best sellers.
Tim Breen.
Some of David Shai's comments brings out a truculent streak in me. There's a great deal written and been said about American farm life, agrarianism, much of it by folks that don't have to do the drudgery in the fields, who reflect upon what the virtue of the farm life might be or might not be, the images, the romanticism, the sentimentality in print. Indeed, I would say that most of what intellectuals or academics say or know about farm life or agrarian life, it comes from sources that aren't very near the soil. Now, it's fine to look at the development of literary images, and I think they do tell us something. Earlier you asked, would I reject it or not use it as a social historian? Of course I would use it. On the other hand, my particular point of view in this course has been, and I think it's one that has been overlooked by many historians, is how farm peoples shape their own world, how the people that actually do the work transform or translate values into forms of behavior, find meaning and community in farm life, with often without the help of governments or universities or programs. And it is in this exciting byplay between the environment, the opportunities of the environment, and the aspirations of particular groups of men and women, be they Indians, sharecroppers, first settlers, that I think that you find the true drama of American agricultural life that very seldom has been explored.
John Seeley, do you have a comment?
Yes, one of the problems, as one of our prominent critic scholars, American historian named Henry Nash Smith, pointed out years ago in a book called Virgin Land, is that farm life as it is generally lived does not produce much in the way of dramatic literature. That is to say, it's largely a life of repeated chores. Not much happens in terms of melodrama. Most early writings in the 19th century, or even into the middle part of the century, that attempted to present American farm life had to introduce these melodramatic materials. But on the other hand, listening to Tim's criticism of the literateurs who write about the farming life but don't experience it, of course, Whittier had. Whittier's Snowbound is an autobiographical poem. He knew full well what it was like to be a farm boy. I think more recently, Louis Bromfield, who is probably among the moderns, the writer who has written most about the agricultural life, knew that life.
Or Wendell Berry today.
All right, and a similar figure would be Robert Frost. Now, Frost was not a farmer in the sense that his livelihood absolutely depended upon it, but for a long time he was a struggling poet and certainly lived off the work of his hands, and was probably one of the most effective and evocative writers about the rural life. And yet, oddly enough, Frost is writing, as is Whittier, still from a relatively nostalgic point of view, of writing of a simpler life against which our modern life must be tested, a perspective. What I think we're trying to do, or at least I'd like to see us do, as this course comes to an end, is to point out that farming life is not nostalgia. Farming life is with us. It's very much a part of our contemporary scene. It's very much a part of our contemporary problems. It's not really something we can encapsulate and call it the good old days with and accompany Bobby Frost down to the spring to get a bucket of water for his calf. That is no longer what farming is, and yet that is often what people conceptualize as farming, largely because of the poetic imagery that has been engendered. Mm-hmm. The absolute ideal, democratic, altruistic American farmer has always been, to a certain extent, the product of a politician's imagination, and will probably continue to be. It would be good if farming in this country could be carried on by small family farms. I think that would be my preference also. I think the likelihood that it will, say, 50 years from now, is not very great.
Tim Breen.
John Seeley suggests a very fruitful line of investigation, one that I think I'm going to say is very speculative, but I believe it to be true, probably because I want it to be. He talks about politicians projecting onto their policies certain myths, certain assumptions about farming. And it is interesting, as the family farm is celebrated, perhaps in its decline, many of the policies of the federal government, Washington, are doing whatever they can, the agricultural department, to promote agribusiness. Agribusiness enjoys access to power in the way that no family farmer or group of family farmers ever could hope to. On the other hand, you think of the implications of the mythology or the powerfully evocative factors about the family farm as an element in foreign policy. I suspect that many of our criticisms or our aspirations as a nation for land reform in the Third World can come as much out of our own feelings about land and land use in the Midwest or in the South, about the family farm, about the little producer, as much out of that heritage as it does to a knowledge of the local cultures which we're trying to reform.
Timothy Breen of Northwestern University, David Shy of Davidson College, and John Seeley of the University of Florida have all completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center, where each worked on a topic in American literary and historical scholarship. Each recently served as a faculty member for a summer institute for high school teachers of history at the National Humanities Center. The topic was agriculture and the agrarian tradition in American culture. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on the Anthropology of Hunting in the American South, and on agriculture in American history, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a discussion featuring scholars from Indiana University and Amherst College about historical and contemporary views of the classics, who defines them, who reads them, and who uses them to what ends. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me this week for discussions about two aspects of the American landscape: the anthropology of hunting in the American South and the role of agriculture in American history. Anthropologist Stuart Marks will discuss his forthcoming study of hunters in the American South, a conspicuous group that provides an understanding of contemporary Southern social symbols, rituals, and myth. Also on Soundings this week, scholars from Davidson College, Northwestern University, and the University of Florida will discuss the historical and contemporary pertinence of agriculture in American society. Two views of the American landscape this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.